Okay, let's start with John Dryden. First, that a metaphrase, or turning an author word by word and line by line from one language into another. Thus, or near this manner, was Horace, his art of poetry translated by Ben Jonson. The second way is that a paraphrase, or translation with latitude, where the author had kept in view by the translator, so as never to be lost, but his words are not so strictly followed as his sense, and that too is admitted to be amplified, but not altered. Such is Mr. Waller's translation of Virgil's fourth Aeneid. The third way is that of imitation, where the translator, if now he has not lost that name, assumes the liberty not only to vary from the words and sense, but to forsake them both as he sees occasion, and taking only some general hints from the original, to run division on the groundwork as he pleases. Such is Mr. Cowley's practice in turning two odes of Pindar and one of Horace into English. Concerning the first of these methods, our master Horace has given us this caution. Nec verbum verbo corabis redere fides interpretes. Nor word for word too faithfully translate. As the Earl of Roscommon has excellently rendered it, too faithfully is indeed pedantically. 'Tis a faith like that which proceeds from superstition, blind and zealous. Take it in the expression of Sir John Denham to Sir Richard Fanshawe on his version of Pastor Fido. That servile path thou nobly dost decline, of tracing word by word and line by line, a new and nobler way thou dost pursue, to make translations and translators too. They but preserve the ashes, thou the flame, true to his sense, but truer to his fame. Tis almost impossible to translate verbally and well at the same time. For the Latin, a most severe and compendious language, often expresses that in one word, which either the barbarity or the narrowness of modern tongues cannot supply and more. 'Tis frequent also that the conceit is couched in some expression which will be lost in English. Atque idem binti vela ferinque ferent. What poet of our nation is so happy as to express his thought literally in English, and to strike wit or almost sense out of it? In short, the verbal copier is encumbered with so many difficulties at once that he can never disentangle himself from all. He is to consider, at the same time, the thought of his author and his words, and to find out the counterpart to each in another language. And besides this, he is to confine himself to the compass of numbers and the slavery of rhyme. 'Tis much like dancing on ropes with fettered legs. A man may shun a fall by using caution, but the gracefulness of motion is not to be expected. And when we have said the best of it, 'tis but a foolish task, for no sober man would put himself into a danger for the applause of scaping without breaking his neck. We see Ben Jonson could not avoid obscurity in his literal translation of Horace, attempted in the same compass of lines. Nay, Horace himself could scarce have done it to a Greek poet. Breves esse laboro obscurus fiu. Either perspicuity or gracefulness will frequently be wanting. Horace has indeed avoided both these rocks in his translation of the first three lines of Homer's Odysseys, which he has contracted into two. The consideration of these difficulties in a servile literal translation not long since made two of our famous wits, Sir John Denham and Mr. Cowley, to contrive another way of turning authors into their tongue, called by the latter of them imitation. As they were friends, I suppose they communicated their thoughts on this subject to each other, and therefore their reasons for it are a little different, though the practice of one is much more moderate. I take imitation of an author in their sense to be an endeavor of a later poet to write like one who has written before him on the same subject, that is, not to translate his words or to be confined to his sense, but only to set him as a patron, and to write as he supposes that author would have done had he lived in our age and in our country. But I know not what mischief may arise hereafter from the example of such an innovation, when writers of unequal parts to him shall imitate so bold an undertaking, to add and to diminish what we please, which is the way avowed by him, ought to be granted to Mr. Cowley, and that too only in his translation of Pindar, because he alone was able to make him amends, by giving him better of his own, whenever he refused his author's thoughts. Pindar is generally known to be a dark writer and to want connection. I mean, as to our understanding, to soar out of sight and leave his reader at a gaze. So wild and ungovernable poet cannot be translated literally. His genius is too strong to bear a chain. And Samson, like he shakes it off, a genius so elevated and unconfined as Mr. Cowley's, was but necessary to make Pindar speak English. And that was to be performed by no other way than imitation. But if Virgil or Ovid or any regular intelligible authors be thus used, 'tis no longer to be called their work, when neither their thoughts nor words are drawn from the original, but instead of them, there is something new produced, which is almost the creation of another hand. By this way, 'tis true somewhat that is excellent may be invented, perhaps more excellent than the first design, though Virgil must still be accepted when that perhaps takes place. Yet he who is inquisitive to know the author's thoughts will be disappointed in his expectation. And 'tis not always that a man will be contented to have a present made him when he expects the payment of a debt. To state it fairly, imitation of an author is the most advantageous way for a translator to shew himself. But the greatest wrong which can be done to the memory and reputation of the dead. Sir John Denham, who advised more liberty than he took himself, gives this reason for his innovation in his admirable preface before the translation of the Second Aeneid. Poetry is of so subtle a spirit that in pouring out of one language into another, it will all evaporate. And if a new spirit be not added in the transfusion, there will remain nothing but a caput mortem. And I repeat, poetry is of so subtle a spirit that in pouring out of one language into another, it will all evaporate. And if a new spirit be not added in the transfusion, there will remain nothing but a caput mortem. I confess this argument holds good against a literal translation, but who defends it? Imitation and verbal version are, in my opinion, the two extremes, which ought to be avoided. And therefore, when I propose the mean betwixt them, it will be seen how far this argument will reach. But since every language is so full of its own properties, that what is beautiful in one is often barbarous and sometimes nonsense in another, it would be unreasonable to limit a translator to the narrow compass of his author's words. 'Tis enough if he chooses out some expression which does not vitiate the sense. I suppose he may stretch his chain to such a latitude, but by innovation of thoughts, methinks he breaks it. By this means, the spirit of an author may be transfused, and yet not lost. And thus 'tis plain that the reason alleged by Sir John Denham has no farther force than to expression for thought, if it be translated truly, cannot be lost in another language. But the words that convey it to our apprehension, which are the image and ornament of that thought, may be so ill chosen as to make it appear an unhandsome dress, and rob it of its native luster. There is therefore a liberty to be allowed for the expression, neither is it necessary that words and lines should be confined to the measure of their original. The sense of an author, generally speaking, is to be sacred and inviolable. He states also that Tiz is the painter's job to copy the original. Perhaps the face which he has drawn would be more exact if the eyes or nose were altered, but 'tis his business to make it resemble the original. In two cases only there may a seeming difficulty arise, that is, if the thought be notoriously trivial or dishonest, but the same answer will serve for both, that then they ought not be to be translated. Okay. It be thought by better judges that the praise of a translation consists in adding new beauties to the piece, thereby to recompense the loss which it sustains by change of language. I shall be willing to be taught better and to recant. In the meantime, it seems to me that the true reason why we have so few versions which are tolerable is not from the too close pursuing of the author's sense, but because there are so few who have all the talents which are requisite for translation, and that there is so little praise and so small encouragement for so considerable a part of learning. So he concludes this way: for my own part, I am ready to acknowledge that I have transgressed the rules which I have given, taken more liberty than a just translation will allow. But so many gentlemen whose wit and learning are well known, being joined in it, I doubt not but that their excellencies will make you ample satisfaction for my errors.